We are in Luke chapter 9. We have come in the paragraph that is marked by verses 18 through 27 to the statement of Jesus in verse 23 for this morning. We began this study last week, but it said, "If anyone wishes to come after me." And the first look that we gave to this text last week, we saw that Jesus said some things that must be true of anyone who wants to go beyond what I called last week mayonnaise jar Christianity. That's a reference to the idea of just changing the label without bothering to change the contents. And of course, we can't do either. We can apply a label to ourselves, but we really can't change the real label, and we can't change the contents of the jar. That's God's business. But nonetheless, in our cultural setting, after 2,000 years of Christianity, we often do discover that there are all kinds of distortions that have happened, and claiming a label that's not legitimate is one of those problems that we face. So in our look at what goes beyond that mayonnaise jar Christianity into an honest, real relationship with following Him, we saw that He said, if anyone wishes to do that, you'll have to deny yourself. And we spent most all of our time talking about what that means, and we tried to draw our meaning from the illustrations that are given to us in the Scriptures regarding denial. We found that that word is only used with one exception of the records of this requirement, as the Gospel writers give it, and the example that Peter acted out in the night that Jesus was betrayed, in which he denied the Lord three times. This is where this word is used. And we drew our conclusion from that the issue of denial is not so much asceticism, though there's some degree of denial of the appetites of the body involved in this, but asceticism is a human perversion of denial of yourself. It makes people very proud of their control they have over their bodies. And Paul says in Colossians that it's worthless in terms of real spiritual production. So we didn't look in the direction of asceticism. We looked in the direction of Romans 7, where Paul talks about denying the old association that we have had with Adam and embracing fully the new association that we have with Jesus as a new husband in the Romans 7 concept. So denying ourselves really has to do with denying our association with our old Adamic nature. That's what it means to deny ourselves. You're not going to run this show anymore. I don't know you. Just like Peter said of Jesus. I don't know him. I have been fully associated with a new man, and he's the only one I know. I don't know you. That's the self-denial concept. Now, in this verse, if anyone wishes to come after me, there are two other things that Jesus said must happen. We must, he said, take up our cross daily. And then we must follow him. So this morning we're going to be looking at this second issue of necessity. If we're going to take up our cross and follow him, we're going to have to understand what that means. This requirement, like almost everything in the Bible after 2,000 years of exposure to cultures and shifting doctrinal things with men, has more than its fair share of attachments made to it over the years, and that just makes it more necessary for us to attempt to identify what Jesus really meant when he said, take up your cross daily. Now, I do want to make this observation as we move into our study, and that is this, that Jesus made that comment before he was crucified. We tend to hear that comment on the basis of our post-crucifixion experience. When we hear him say, take up your cross daily, we probably don't hear it the same way the disciples did, because they didn't have the perspective we have. And I've decided, for myself anyway, and my understanding of this, that Jesus probably said this more for the impact that it would make down the road than he did for the moment, because we know that for the moment, the disciples apparently didn't get it, because they didn't do it. And the record of their hard-headed, hard-heartedness is what Jesus called it, over the next months and perhaps years, proved that they didn't get it. And the night that he was betrayed and was headed to condemnation, they all fled into the darkness because they hadn't been taking up their cross daily and they weren't about to start now. So I really do think our understanding of the terminology is probably legitimate in that Jesus made this comment from self-understanding exactly what was going to happen, but the disciples not having a real good grip on that. Even though he had just said in verse 22 that he was going to be rejected and killed, they probably did not think of Roman crucifixion in that light. I mean, when he said killed, they probably didn't have that in their mind, so they might have. Jesus, on occasion, had already been subjected to the possibility of being stoned, so they may have had that in mind. So when he said, you have to take up your cross daily, they had to figure out what he meant, just like we do. In order to try to figure out what taking up our cross daily means, I'm going to start my attempt to understand that with some comments about the nature of truth itself. In our culture, truth has been squished to the point that it almost doesn't have an identity in its reality in the hearts and minds of hardly anyone. Our culture has developed an intense commitment to tolerance and relativity, and because of that, we find ourselves drifting in the direction of the notion that, well, that might not be true. Or, even if it's true, there are probably some qualifying things about it that make it so that I don't have to do it. The end result of it is that we find ourselves slipping and sliding along the path. And the tragedy is that in this verse, Jesus said, if you want to come after me, this has got to happen. Which means that truth has an adamant identity. And in the context, as long as we're reluctant to make that non-negotiable sacred commitment to the principle of denying our association with our old man, we will find ourselves with nothing underfoot to hold our steps. We will not be able to take up our cross because we have not taken that first step in denying ourselves. But even if we've taken that first step, we have to understand that the truth is not negotiable. It's an absolute. It is the nature of truth to be absolute and non-negotiable and completely immutable, with every manner of built-in consequences for both its application to our decision-making as well as our refusal to apply it to our decision-making. The truth is the truth in the sense that it stands immutable with certain automatic downline repercussions, and it is not ever going to change for us. So if Jesus said this must happen, it must happen. How it must happen is a methodological question, but the fact is it has to. It's truth. And I want us to think about the truth a little bit along that line. There is this immutability to it. It wouldn't be true if it could shift and move and change and alter and become what it's not. That's the purpose of saying that Jesus, who said he was the truth, is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He is immutable. He does not change. The truth does not change. But in light of that, I want you to be aware of something that Paul said at the end of Romans 11, to which we have not yet come in our studies. But there is not only just an immutability to truth, there is also an inscrutability. Because in verse 33 of Romans 11, the Apostle Paul said, oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable his ways. I like the King James phraseology better, though we might not get the same concept out of it. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 23 and 24, the wisest man who ever lived on this planet before Jesus came, King Solomon, said in Ecclesiastes 7, 23 and 24, that he was going to apply himself to wisdom, and he discovered it was a vanity because the stuff that's going on has a backlog of inscrutability to it that makes it so mysterious that even if you apply your heart diligently to wisdom, you'll still be kind of out there. Because the truth is a reflection or an essence of the character of God, and He is immense, and that means there's no boundaries. So obviously, even though it's immutable, it's also to some degree inscrutable, and that's a challenge for us, because we have to live with the fact that it's not going to change, but we may not fully understand it. In fact, we will not fully understand anything. And then, thirdly, not only is it immutable and secondly inscrutable, but thirdly, there is this grace issue that the New Testament highlights, and that complicates truth. It's a part of truth, but the fact is that God often completely unseats what men think that they will accomplish by applying what they think is absolutely true, because they take a portion of what is absolutely true and forget that there is a counterbalance to that, and then in their application of the thing that they think they've completely figured out, God comes along and unseats it, because not because He's not true, but because He's gracious. For example, if you take the law of God as an absolute statement of His truth, you would be right on target. It is. But if you think that the justice of God will tell you everything you need to know about how things are going to work, you're wrong. Because in a cause and effect universe, justice will tell you what righteousness would, if you do this, this is going to happen. But justice is notorious for letting mercy and grace out the door, leaving it out. And the consequence of that is that you do this, and you expect this, and God comes along, and you do this, and He inserts some grace in it, and something else happens, and in a little while you don't know what to think. Because He just doesn't do the just thing, He does the gracious or merciful thing. And that is a complication to our grasp. And in fact, it's the reason why some people throw up their hands and say, there's no point to this, it's all relative. But the real truth of that is that none of these things undoes the fact that truth cannot be ignored with impunity. And that's the whole thing. You can't look at just a portion and expect that that's the whole picture, nor can you look at an opposite portion and think that's the whole picture. And we don't have the brains to put them together and think that that's the whole picture. The fact is, we don't have the whole picture. But that does nothing to unseat this, that if Jesus said, you must take up your cross daily, He's uttering something that is true, and we have absolutely no wiggle room in terms of not taking Him seriously there. The problem is that the language is enormously intimidating, and if there is some wiggle room, we want to find it. So, having said those things about the truth, I want us to move one step further along in our attempt to figure out what it means to take up a cross on a daily basis, and that is, I want us to consider Jesus' example. We'll come back to it in a little while, but in terms of an initial thought, when Jesus uttered the words, taking up your cross, He was doing it understanding. He knew where He was headed. And because of what that cross meant in terms of the relationships that existed in the Trinity between Father, Son, and Spirit, if there had been any other truth that could have taken the place of the cross, surely God would have applied it. You can't believe, if you understand anything about the Bible, you cannot believe that God would have subjected His Son to the cross if there had been an alternative that was workable. It's just impossible to go down that path biblically. I know a lot of people will go down it anyway, but that's just the nature of our fallenness. The fact is, God the Father would have never allowed Calvary to occur if there had been some other alternative to the necessity of taking up the cross. It was true for Jesus. And because Jesus had to take up his cross, anybody who wants to come after him is going to have to take up theirs too, because he is the one who sets the standard for all, because he's superior to the rest. If it was true for him, it's going to be more true for us, because he didn't have to fight depravity to do it. We do. And yet, if it was necessary for the Son of God to take up a cross in order to be able to set the pattern, then we have to take up a cross too. In fact, Peter makes pretty big deal about the fact that Jesus set the standard for us so that we're to arm ourselves with the same mind. So, we've looked at truth as an immutable, inscrutable, grace-complicated reality, and we've considered Jesus as the superior human who had to take up the cross. What about that cross that brings us into this text that gives us some understanding of what it might mean for you and me? I want us to think of at least five factors that are involved in taking up the cross daily. Jesus said it has to happen. You can't follow me if you don't. In fact, in chapter 14 of Luke, he says this: if you want to be my disciple, you have to take up your cross. If you don't, you can't be my disciple. That's pretty serious. So, I want to point out some things that I've discovered about the cross in my study, and we'll think our way through what that might mean for you and me today. The first thing that I want to refer to, and in spite of the fact that the scriptures don't push this issue the way humans do, when you read about Jesus being crucified, the facts are there, but they're not overblown and they're not pressed real far. They're just recorded. But one of the things you cannot read those texts and not see is the brutality of the cross. It's brutal. There was no administration of any kind of painkilling remedy when they drove those spikes through his hands and his feet. And according to those who studied it more than I have, they chose the most sensitive nerve centers in your body at the hand and foot locations that would create an excruciating pain, more so than if it was driven through some other part. And when we read about them driving these nails through his hands and his feet, and all of the stuff that came before, and some of the stuff that followed after, because they put him on a cross so that he couldn't even inhale without moving up to give his chest enough room to move, and to move up, he had to either press with feet that were nailed or pull with hands that were nailed, and in either case, it was brutal. And this may be, for 20th century Americans, the most difficult aspect of Jesus' demand, partly because it is so brutal and we're fearful of it, and secondly, because few of us are ever called upon to face anything as brutal as the cross, so we don't know what to do with this. How do you take this up daily in light of its brutality when the vast majority of us are going to live and die without ever facing anything as brutal as the cross? What typically happens is we morph the terminology so that it means something far less than, I have to take, this is my cross I have to bear. And what are they talking about? Oh, some yappy dog that won't shut up during the night. Or perhaps a broken finger that they got goofing around. Or whatever. This is my cross I have to bear. Well, it's not. Sort of it is, but goodness. You think about the brutality of the cross, and all of a sudden, most of anything that you've ever experienced just kind of pales in comparison. Hardly qualifies. In fact, it's almost blasphemous to call it a cross when it's such a minor thing. So here we are, puzzled about what it can possibly mean, given the fact that it was so brutal. And adding to the problem in this concept of brutality of what Jesus said, take up his cross daily, You know, there aren't very many places in the Bible where kata hemeron or hemeron is used, which means daily. There are many things that we're urged to do on a daily basis, but very few of them are urged upon us with the phrase daily. And yet here he says, this has got to be an everyday thing. And yet, given the brutality of it, we have to wonder, what do you mean? Because the fact of the cross for Jesus was that his whole life was an incremental movement toward one act of taking up the cross at the end. And he lived his life under the promise of the psalm that God had said of Messiah, he will give his angels charge concerning you so that you won't even stump your toe. That's a paraphrase. But if he went through his life perfectly healthy and he never stubbed his toe, what did he know about pain? And yet his whole life was moving in this inexorable march toward the brutality of the cross. And we look at that and we say, no, okay, Jesus, what do you mean, take up your cross daily? What makes it up? Of what does it consist? And so I want to say this about that. In answer to the daily cross issue, in light of the brutality reality, there is the physical issue. And I really believe that what he's dealing with here is a summons to his disciples to take seriously the problems of the body's demandingness, especially in relation to pain, because that's what the brutality was all about. Pain was designed to be painful. And what that means is that the cross was a physical phenomenon that challenged the individual at the level of enduring physical pain with gratitude rather than anger. When was the last time you really hurt yourself? And what was your immediate reaction? More times than not, anger. And then maybe whining. I've heard people who are believers for long years who suddenly were hurt physically and the first words out of their mouth were curses. Blaming God or damning something because of God or whatever. And what that means is that there's got to be a way to respond to physical pain that it does not involve that. It doesn't involve anger or whining or damning or anything. It has to do with being able to reflect on the reality and coming up with gratitude. I don't know, you weren't as sensitive to this message as I was when we were singing, but in the song it says, whether pain or pleasure. We sang that. Well, I really do believe that taking up our cross daily does mean learning how to handle the negative side of the attempt of our physical bodies to control us. Because pain is one of the primary controllers that the physical realm has to offer. There are only two ways that your body can control you. One of them is by the infliction of pain or the feeling of it. On the other is the production of pleasure and the seduction of pleasure by the body. So, in a very real sense, our bodies want to be our tyrants. They want to rule us, and we have to deny the body without becoming ascetic. But the fact is, the issue of dealing with taking up the cross daily is probably Jesus' way of saying, look, your life might be like mine. It may be bringing you to a cross, a real one, immense, brutal pain. And how are you going to handle it if you haven't learned how? So every day when you run into the painful issues, physically painful issues, take your cross daily. Learn how to handle the physical painful issues of your day with gratitude and not whining or anger or blasphemy or any of those other things. I think that that's where it starts. In light of the brutality issue, I believe that taking up our cross daily is Jesus' way of saying, look, you need to harden off. Do you know that term? You take a little tomato seed and you plant it in a little cup of potting soil sometime before frost is done with for the year. So the seed germinates and it grows up and it's in your house and it's a comfortable whatever temperature you live at. and then you decide you're going to transplant it to your garden. If you just take it out of your comfortable little house and stick it out there in the brutal garden, it will die. More than likely. Unless you wait until June or July. But the fact is, you got to harden the plants off by subjecting them a little at a time to lower temperatures until they can stand it, and then you put them out there in that brutal environment. 50 degrees. Brutal. What I'm saying is, we're like that. At some point, we have to stop being dominated by the pain issues of our bodies. And it's not easy. So that's one of the issues, I think, involved in taking up the cross daily. It's Jesus' way of saying, learn how to handle what your body dishes out, what your circumstances dishes out to your body. Learn how to handle that with gratitude. And over time, you will harden off so that you can stand the most excruciating pain, if it's necessary, when the time comes. Beyond brutality, though, I think that there's something else that we struggle with more than, well, we struggle with it greatly. And that is this fact about the cross. It was completely unwarranted. Jesus hadn't done anything to deserve this. Beyond the pain issues, the injustice of the cross calls on us to look at injustice in a different light than we're used to. The scream, "It's not fair!" is learned early. How many times have you parents heard this? Little kid doesn't know anything about justice, but they know how to say, "It's not fair!" Well, why are they saying that? Because they want to stop whatever's happening from happening. And usually it has something to do with sharing your toys or not getting the ice cream or, you know, "It's not fair!" It doesn't have anything to do with fair. It has to do with trying to stop the situation that's happening. And when we think about whether something's fair or not, we tend to invest that "it's not fair" accusation with a lot of power. And that's the way we think. If it's not fair, it shouldn't be happening. Well, according to 1 Peter 3:17, and I would like for you to look at that, because the issues in 1 Peter are critical to the whole problem of living in an unfair world. I mean, the theme of 1 Peter has to do with suffering and developing out of that. In chapter 3, verse 17, we read these startling words by Peter. "It is better, if God should will it so, that you suffer for doing what's right rather than for doing what's wrong." Now, I want you to think about suffering here in light of this statement. It's better, if the will of God should be so that you would have to suffer, it's better that your suffering be caused by injustice rather than justice. It's better, if you have to suffer, to be suffering for doing what's right rather than simply getting what's coming to you. Now, I want you to think about that. He's saying that injustice is preferable to justice when it comes to learning how to endure. Now, I know that's a shock. We think that if we can scream, "It's not fair!" loud enough, that we can stop what's happening. And Peter says, "You're not looking at it right." You know, Philippians chapter 2, verse 8 and 9 says that Jesus humbled himself to the death of the cross, the most unjust thing that ever happened in all of human history, and angelic history too, for that matter. And you know what the next verse says, verse 9? "Wherefore, God hath also highly exalted him above every name that's named." And what that says is this. The reason for the fact that it's preferable, if you have to suffer, for it to be unjust rather than just, is because God reacts when you have to suffer for injustice, if it's unjust. God's reaction is, "Okay, I'll let that happen right now. But if you think that you're going to demean my child that way, I've got another thing for you to think about, because when I'm through with allowing you to do this unjust thing to my child, I'm going to make it worth his while, so that the very thing that you think you're doing by hurting him, I'm going to turn it completely around Jesus got the highest name of all the names because he was willing to go to the lowest depth of injustice without whining or complaining. So, beyond pain, we're summoned to look at the injustice thing in a different light. All of a sudden, it's not quite the bugaboo that it could be if we don't take up our cross. So at the physical level, it's a method of looking at injustice as an instrument by God to elevate and exalt the sufferer. But you know, beyond the pain level, the injustice of the cross is not a physical thing. It's a spiritual thing. Look over at Acts chapter 5, verse 41, passage that I often refer to, so you'll know it as soon as you see it. But in Acts chapter 5, verse 41, it says this, "So they went on their way from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they had been considered worthy to suffer shame for his name." Now that's right on the heels of verse 40. "They took his advice, and after calling the apostles in, they flogged them and ordered them to speak no more in the name of Jesus. And then they said, now you can go." They beat the living tar out of them, commanded them to stop preaching, and said, okay, now you can go. So they went away from a flogging that was as unjust as it could possibly be. And the text says that they went rejoicing, that they had been considered worthy to suffer shame for his name. Now, what is this considered worthy business? Well, that's a spirit issue. At the level of your spirit, beyond the body, at the level of your spirit, there is one issue that stands above everything else, and that is what others think of you. Because that's a spiritual thing. It's your status in the eyes of other people, or the persons. Now, in that light, what another person thinks of you directly affects your spirit. And at that level, the most significant other person in the universe is God. Now, the religious establishment showed the disciples what they thought of them when they flogged them. But did the disciples get all weenied out on that? No. They deliberately decided, because they understood the issues of taking up their cross at this point, they deliberately decided that if God hadn't had confidence that they could withstand this, he would not have allowed them to be subject to it. And because he allowed them to be subject to it, it meant he had confidence in them, and he counted them worthy. And that's phenomenal for the Spirit, to have a statement made by God how valuable you are to him and what he thinks that you can handle. I know there are some people who say, well, I wish he didn't think I was so capable of handling. You know, I'd like my load to be a little lighter. No, not if you adopt the mentality of the cross-bearing on a daily basis. God thought they were worth trusting over this treatment. That's what they said. And the issue is not pride. The word for rejoicing in this text is not the exulting thing that can easily move into pride. It's the rejoicing that comes out of grace. It dawned on them, perhaps while they were being flogged. You know, this wouldn't be happening to us if we weren't telling them about Jesus. And God's the one who told us to tell them about Jesus. So if this is happening to us, it must be something that he's permitting. And he wouldn't permit it. Paul said, you're not ever subjected to anything beyond your capacity that he's developed in you. He wouldn't be permitting this if he didn't count us worthy. So he did. And they went away. I'm sure their bodies hurt. That's what happens when you get flogged. But they went away rejoicing. It's a spiritual thing. But if you go beyond the body and the spirit, and Trey's going to say, no, every sermon, body, soul, and spirit. I want you to go back to 1 Peter chapter 4. That's all right, Trey. I don't mind. It's true. Everything's body, soul, and spirit. But I want you to look at 1 Peter 4:19. "Therefore, let those also who suffer according to the will of God. Now remember, it's better if it's the will of God for you to suffer for injustice rather than justice. It's better for those who suffer according to the will of God. He said, let those who suffer according to the will of God entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what's right. So it's a soul issue. And you know what that means? You know how most people respond to suffering? What did I do to deserve this? Why is God punishing me? Is my life so far out of line that I have to be subjected to this because God's trying to get me to come back? I mean, what's going on? Why is He beating on me? Why does He hate me so much? And, you know, instead of suffering being an indicator of God's relational displeasure, like most people do think, according to this text, it's an indication of His deep faithfulness. It says, if you have to suffer, entrust your souls to a faithful Creator. It's an abiding faithfulness on His part. Now, what does that mean? Well, deep faithfulness involves a couple of things. One of them is record keeping. In the book of the Revelation, we're told that there are books being recorded in heaven of every deed done by every human person on the planet. Every idle word, Jesus said. Everything is being recorded. And the record keeping is a part of the faithfulness of the Creator. And out of the record keeping will come one of two things. Either the dispensing of justice upon those who have engaged in injustice. In other words, He's going to bring the hammer down on those who have persisted in pursuing injustice against other people and have refused to come to repentance. He is going to hammer them in the end. It will cost them their eternal destiny. Deep faithfulness on the Creator's part has to do with record keeping and dispensing justice, but as we said at the beginning of our study, sometimes He doesn't dispense justice. Sometimes He dispenses grace. In other words, the person who engaged in the injustice doesn't get justice. He gets grace. Now, how's that supposed to affect our souls, according to verse 19 of 1 Peter 4? Well, on the one hand, the dispensing of justice vindicates the believer's confidence in the validity of believing in a faithful relationship with God. Instead of taking the pain of the body and saying, why is God being so mean to me? They take the attitude that, you know, God wouldn't have put this on me if He didn't trust me. I'm going to rejoice that He has confidence that I can handle this by His grace, but I'm still going to rejoice even if it is His grace. The issue is, He has given a vote of confidence by the thing suffered. And that vote of confidence is going to end up in His dealing with those who have persecuted His people unjustly. He's going to deal with them if they remain in that mode. So, at the soul level, we have a believing relationship with a faithful God. He's a faithful King who will bring to judgment those who have persecuted His people. But on the other hand, the dispensing of grace, you know, that vindicates the believer's confidence in the validity of a believing relationship with a faithful Redeemer. And what I mean by that is this. At the soul level, we thrive on a relationship with God. If we don't have a relationship with Him, our souls are dead. And at the soul level, where a relationship is everything, the whole issue of confidence is critical. Because you've got to have confidence if you're going to be in a relationship. And relationships fall apart by a lack of trust. But the fact is, when God uses our unjust suffering to impact the thinking of someone else so as to bring them to a saving knowledge of Himself, we suddenly rejoice not only that we were counted worthy to suffer for Him, but we rejoice that He was willing to use our suffering for somebody else's eternal benefit. And it's an enormously stimulating fact to hear somebody's testimony where they came to know Jesus because they watched you suffer unfairly and saw how you handled it And maybe they were the ones dishing it out. But in any case, grace or justice, the soul of man who trusts in his King and Redeemer is strengthened. So, it's brutal physically. Spiritually, it's enormously encouraging. He thinks you're capable. He trusts you. He thinks you're worthy. And then, at the soul level, because of your willingness to take up your cross every day, you have this real relationship, and it just grows day by day. So, in spite of the fact that it was completely unwarranted, God is using it. So those are two of the five things that I said we wanted to consider. It was brutal, and it was unwarranted. But we have to stop thinking in terms of, it's not fair. We have to start thinking in terms of confidence in God in the face of the injustice. The third thing that I want to mention is that the cross was without any kind of a surrogate. Now, the text does tell us that Jesus had his cross borne by Simon of Cyrene once he fell down and couldn't carry it anymore, but that wasn't his, he didn't instigate that. He didn't fall down so somebody would feel sorry for him. He'd been up, no telling how many hours, we know he'd been up the day before and all night, and he'd been brutalized with a flogging and all that stuff, and then he was having to carry this heavy beam cross, and his physical body finally failed. He stumbled and fell. The point that I want to make about this is that taking up our cross daily has to do with not shoving it off on somebody else. Galatians 6:2 says that the Bible puts a premium on our bearing one another's burdens. We are supposed to be willing to pick up somebody else's cross if they stumble under it. In fact, the text in Galatians 6 is, if somebody falters, you who are spiritual, go and restore them, because we're supposed to bear one another's burdens. So, you see somebody falter under their cross, you're supposed to help them. The Bible puts a premium on that, but within three verses, Galatians 6:5, the Bible also puts an equivalent premium on bearing your own burdens. That can be a pride issue, but it doesn't have to be. It can be a love issue where you say, no, I'm not going to ask somebody else to do this. I can do this. There are people who don't ever want to have to do anything, so they just look for somebody else to do it for them. Well, the Bible has two things it puts a premium on. My willingness to help somebody else bear their burdens, and my willingness to bear my own. And you know what it never says? That I'm supposed to go looking for somebody to bear my burdens. It never says that. Now, it does exhort believers to be watchful with one another, and if you see somebody stumble under the weight of theirs, that you go help them, but it doesn't tell them to ask you to help them. It tells you to go and help them because they've stumbled under it. And we need this sense of personal responsibility to return to us. We're not supposed to be looking at ourselves. We're supposed to be looking this way, out there. And if we see somebody out there stumble under their cross, then we're supposed to try to help them bear their burden. And yet, we're supposed to also be looking out there at the burdens that we're having to bear and say, this is my task. It's my burden. I'm going to carry it. It's my job, not yours. So, when Jesus had to bear his own cross, and it didn't just have to do with carrying it down the way. It had to do with going all the way to the death of the cross. But the fact is, he didn't look for somebody else to do it for him. It was his to do. And then fourthly, and this is the most exciting thing about taking up your cross, it was effective beyond anybody's anticipation. They just couldn't believe. In the first place, they didn't believe that the cross would ever lead to any good immediately after it killed him. They were ready to give up everything and just go on home until he confronted them in his resurrection reality. But the fact is, the cross of Jesus Christ was the most significant demonstration of effective power in all of human and angelic history.
Nothing else could bring dead sinners to life. Absolutely nothing else. It was the most effective thing that ever happened. And therefore, I draw the conclusion that the daily cross-bearing of the believer is redemptive. God will use it if we take up our cross every day and bear it. He will use it. It's redemptive. It was for Jesus. It will be for us. That's what Peter said. Paul said the same basic thing in Galatians 6:9. And then finally, fifthly, it also became the pattern for daily living. I said this when I pointed out that it says daily, that there aren't very many things in the Scriptures that have this daily adverb attached or phrase. But Jesus didn't hesitate here. He said, if you want to come after me, this is a daily thing for you. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15:31 that he died daily. Well, he didn't mean that literally. But he did mean it. And what that meant was, he was ready every day for whatever it was he had to face, even if it was physical, painful death. Because it was his pattern to die daily. When he rolled out of bed in the morning, or rolled off his pallet, or however they got up. It was with this understanding. I have no idea what today holds for me, but I will face it by faith in my faithful Redeemer. And if He chooses to let some unjust person do some injustice to me today, I will accept that off His hand with gratitude and no whining, because He is going to use it for my personal spiritual growth, and perhaps even for the spiritual growth of someone else. And not only did he die daily, but he claimed in Galatians 6:14 that it was by the cross that he was crucified to the world. And Peter says, if you've suffered in the flesh, you cease from sin. That's pretty potent stuff for daily behavior. Now, I have to wind this up by saying this. There is a caveat in here. There's a big B-U-T in bold letters. There's a powerful tendency in man to simply assume that anything that's a part of the pattern for daily living is his responsibility, which is true. But he weds it to an assumption that's not true, and that is that he's up to the task. That's not true. And we started this message out by talking about how the truth is true. You can't blend it with a lie and make it work. It's true that we're responsible to take up our cross daily. That's absolutely true. That's our responsibility. But can we? Well, not in the flesh. We cannot do this. It is not our ability. We don't have the capacity in ourselves. That's why this statement started with the denial. You have to deny your association with your old man, because he's going to dominate all of your thinking if you don't. You have to embrace your association with your new man, Jesus, and he's going to give you a totally different perspective on everything, including suffering unjustly. And if you embrace that, then, by faith and by the grace of God and the Spirit's work, you can take up your cross every day. But it's with that understanding. I had a friend call me this week, not from here, so don't go wondering who I'm talking about. But he was wallowing in the slough of despond, in despair over what he considers to be his failures as a Christian. He would say, or did say, in effect, that he was a sorry Christian, lousy. He wasn't living up to any of the things he knew. And he was going on and on about how if he just do what he knew, and finally I just interrupted him. I said, you know what you sound like? No, what? I said, you sound like one of those Jews who said, if I just keep this law, and if I just keep this law, and if I just keep this law, and if I just keep this law, God would save me. That's what you sound like. It's all up to you. I said, that's not true. What's true is that God's not looking for performers. He's looking for humility. Because it is out of humility that He's free to live through us. And humility just goes to God whenever you drop the ball and say, God, I failed again. Would you forgive me? I have sinned and I need to be cleansed. It's not about performing. It's about walking day by day by day by day and using 1 John 1:9 for what it was meant, so that there can be cleansing when there needs to be. And it is by that that the Spirit of God is released to do His empowering in us. So, I'm not capable of taking up a cross. The brutality is terrifying. The injustice offends me. And all the rest of that kind of stuff. But the fact is, if I'm willing to walk with Him every day and simply acknowledge it when I drop the ball, when I sin, confess it, He forgives it, I'm amazed that He does, then the power returns to take up the cross, to be thankful instead of... Let me give you just a final illustration and I'll be done. I woke up this morning in what I call a panic mare. That's a nightmare that's driven by panic. I used to have them all the time when I was in school. When I was in high school, I'd have these dreams about having assignments that were due and I couldn't find my locker. I couldn't remember the combination on the lock. Some terrifying something. I was going to be caught without my assignment being done. Big deal. I mean, it's not like nails driven. But I had those regularly through high school. And when I went off to Bible college as a believer, I still had them. And when I graduated from college, I quit having them. Until I went back to seminary. And then I started having them. And so I went 1 year and quit. 10 years later, I decided, oh, I better finish this master's program. It's 3 more years. I started having them again. I'm not in school. I had one last night, this morning. I don't know where it's coming from, but the fact is, I woke up in a panic and in a huge sigh of relief said, thank God that was just a dream. So thankfulness comes up. And you know, if we would do that in our waking hours, when something goes terribly wrong, instead of being driven by panic, if we would just say, thank God that's not real. The reality is, God wouldn't have allowed this if He didn't trust me. And I can commit my soul to a faithful Redeemer, King, Creator, and live in the face of this. So that's what I'm going to do. Jesus said, if you want to follow Him, that's going to have to be the case. You have to deny your association with your old self. You have to embrace your association with Him. And then you have to take up that thing every day where you suffer injustice. You may suffer physically painful injustice without it affecting your spiritual relationship with Him who considers you worthy or He wouldn't have subjected to it, or your soul relationship with Him because He's faithful and you can trust Him. And it is out of that that you build the kind of maturity that enables you to come at the end of the process to real brutality if necessary, to enormous injustice if necessary, without a whimper, because we've grown up. Let's pray together. Father, You paint a mixed picture for us. Most of us are afraid of significant pain. Most of us have real trouble thinking that You count us worthy. And we really do struggle at the level of a faithful Creator who would let His own children suffer difficulty. So we have a lot of things that You need to work out in our brains and in our hearts and in our minds and in our souls and in our spirits. But we pray that You would do it because You are a faithful Creator. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.